Welcome to Dark Mode, the podcast that brings you sage advice from two technology experts. But that's not just what we call ourselves. It's what our moms tell people when they get a little bit cold and they have to do their special event inside. And now we have to redo the whole tech setup for it at a moment's notice. I'm your host, Luke Miani.
And I'm your host, Noah Rubin. On this show, we take questions from listeners, attempt to answer them to varying degrees of success, and maybe even have a laugh or two along the way.
And we have to start by talking about the fact that this is our first episode of 2025. Yes, it's the 19th day of 2025. Sorry about that. But we have missed quite a lot, both in the world of tech and the world outside of tech. I want to start by addressing the fires that we had here in Los Angeles over the past week or so, or more than a week at this point. It has been a really weird time. Some people were like asking on Twitter if I was okay. I am fine. I'm not in an area that was affected by the fires because I don't live near the hills, but it was very weird to see, very scary and really just devastating to watch, not just in terms of the actual natural disaster itself, but in terms of the way that people responded to it. There was kind of the best and worst of humanity over this past week. Last weekend, I went with some friends to do some volunteering at one of the donation centers up near Altadena, and there were so many people there that we had to wait in line to volunteer. They were at capacity. They were not accepting donations anymore. They had just the outpouring of support has been absolutely incredible. People are really coming together. But at the same time, I've seen a lot of things, a lot of comments on news posts, on social media, which are just like, what the hell is wrong with people? The way that people, without even taking a second, because this disaster happened in the state of California, which is kind of a culture war topic, instantaneously, this became a political issue. And I think, frankly, that it's disgusting to watch some of the reactions that people have had to this.
Yeah, it's definitely a crazy situation. A lot of people have been asking me, oh, how are your friends in California? So, you know, I tell them, oh, my friends are okay. I know, you know, you guys obviously are far enough away from it that you're not directly affected. But I do know, you know, family friend had to evacuate and luckily nothing happened to, you know, to their house. But also one of my friends went from the Bay Area to L.A. to visit his friends. And I think like that morning or mid-flight or something, his friends got an evacuation notice. So he literally had to, like, he literally didn't leave the airport. He landed in the airport in Burbank, and then he got another flight, Whoa. And he went straight back to the Bay Area because he just, you know, just couldn't get out, you know?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, stuff. I mean, it is weird to see how close it hits to home, even though, you know, I obviously did not have any direct impact, but the family friend that you mentioned that we both know, that was very scary to see. My old apartment building that you've been to many times was evacuated. It was a brief one because that was not affected by the Palisades fire or the Eaton fire, but there was a brief fire in the Hollywood Hills, and that was pretty close to my old place. And fortunately, that fire was contained within, I think, like 2 or 3 hours, which was really impressive. But definitely a scary thing. I mean, I could see the flames from my house. Yeah, they weren't going to affect me, but I could see it. I woke up. It was very hard to get work done. So that's the other thing I want to address. I'm not scapegoating the fires for the fact that I haven't uploaded in a long time. I haven't uploaded in 2025 yet, which this is the longest amount of time that I have not uploaded a video since probably like 2018. Like, this is an unusual gap for me. So just to let everyone know what's going on, there was a very there's a confluence of things that occurred. Number one is that I moved last month rather unexpectedly, and it's a really big move. So it's taking me quite a bit of time to get settled in here, get things set up. I'm building a studio, which you'll see in a partially completed form soon. One of the other things that came up was one of the components that I needed for that studio was damaged during shipping, and has been about, it's been a month process to get a UPS damage claim so that the shipper could send me another product. Now, I would argue that they should probably just do it right away and then deal with the claim on their own because my product was damaged, but hopefully I should be able to get my studio finished soon. And then I had, so, you know, there was all the there was moving, and then there was the holidays. And then I had another trip that I couldn't move. And then I literally got back from that the day after the fires started. And so then I was like here trying to work, and it was very hard to work when you look out my window in that direction and I see the Eaton fire smoke. When I look out the window the other direction and I see the other fire, you know, I got back and my car was covered in ash. Like, it was a weird, weird vibe in LA over the past week. And the long and the short of it is, I haven't died. I haven't gone away. I am still here working on content. There was other video delays, a whole bunch of things. A bunch of stuff is on the fire. I'm hoping that Monday or Tuesday I can get a video out finally and then get back to normal.
Okay, well, I'm sure we've all missed you, and we're glad glad that you're back.
Yeah, I mean, those YouTube analytics were looking a little dire.
Yeah, you got to feed the algorithm. It's getting hungry.
Oh, it's hungry. I'm hungry too. I'm hungry for some. I'm tired of seeing all those gray down arrows in the YouTube analytics page. It's not what you want to see. But I'll tell you what. You know, there's a lot that we have to catch up on here. It's January 19th, and it feels like quite a bit has already happened. A lot of very political tech things happened in the past week or two. I think it was maybe a week and a half ago that Mark Zuckerberg did his little video, and he walked back all of the fact-checking that was implemented on Meta platforms a couple of years ago, I think during the COVID time frame, right? I think they implemented a bunch of stuff. There was also stuff after the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which was like 8.5 years ago at this point. But basically, what seems to me to be the case is that Mark Zuckerberg is, how can I put this delicately? He's a spineless little bitch, and he's never had an original thought. I mean, look, 8 years ago, when disinformation ran rampant on Facebook, the prevailing discussion at the time was, hey, this guy, this platform's terrible. There's no fact-checking. And then he was like, oh yeah, you're right. We need to do fact-checking. Oh, man. And then two, 3 years ago, everyone said, hey, Mark, you look like a weird alien. Why are you like not even human? And he was like, oh, geez, Rick, I got to grow out my hair, and I'm going to wear chains now, and I'm going to make videos with a $900,000 watch. Am I human now? Am I relatable yet? And then, you know, the tables turned again, and all of a sudden, now it is not in vogue to fact check information. And then he just instantaneously said, oh, okay, all right, I guess you can say whatever you want now, and we'll now make it explicitly allowed on our platforms to cyberbully transgender people and tell them that they have mental illnesses. That's explicitly allowed now. He doesn't have an original thought. He just does whatever the most amount of people seem to tell him to do, that's what he does.
Yeah, I don't know. It is definitely unfortunate that you know that these policies are happening. I guess like I don't know if he's trying to appeal to the like the more far right people. They kind of have their own social networks. I don't know how popular those are, like Truth Social and whatever. Those are really echo chambers. I don't know if he's trying to capture some of that market. I don't know if he's trying to save money on you know, content moderators or to seem cool, like, oh yeah, say whatever you want. I don't know what it is, but like, yeah, I agree with you. It's just like seems like wherever the political wherever the you know the people of the day, like the thought of the day, like, oh, you need content moderation, so we'll do it. Oh, you can relax it now. Oh, we're gonna relax it. Like, it's just very just going with the flow for the, you know, not for the better of it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I without wanting to wade too deeply into political waters on this show, despite the next topic being the TikTok ban, which is inherently political, the reality is, you know, if you mention anything of this sort, even a single time, you're gonna get comments like this: "It was censorship, not fact checking." No, that's not true. Sorry, you're wrong. Here's the thing. Content platforms operate independently. They can do what they want. And if they want to allow you to post anything you want, that's their prerogative. If they want to moderate and protect users from hate speech, protect this from the spread of disinformation, that's kind of up to them. So I personally push back on the mindset that you should be allowed to go on the internet and say anything you want. True, false, hateful, filled with love, doesn't matter. You should be able to say whatever you want. I don't buy into that notion because I think there are certain things, certain lies, certain just misrepresentations of reality, especially now with AI, that I think are a provable detriment to the public good. And if a platform decides that it is best for their user base or best for the society as a whole to not allow certain types of speech that they deem in violation of their terms of service, I think that that should be allowed, straight up. And the thing is, whenever people say stuff like this, "It was censorship, not fact-checking," that only tends to apply when it cuts in their direction. And when the tables are turned and they get to be the ones sort of in charge of the content, what you find is there's quite a bit of suppression in the other direction. Like, you look at Twitter, there's been pretty compelling evidence that I've seen that certain types of accounts and certain keywords are still being suppressed. It's not like anything has been completely changed and like all of a sudden nobody is weighing in. The algorithm is just favoring a different type of discussion, and that tends to be what people like Richard here tend to agree with. So I think A, censoring hate speech and disinformation is not in fact an infringement of free speech. And B, the moves that you find now on Twitter and Meta are not in fact a completely unbiased free speech move. So that's my take.
Yeah, I think I agree. Just because when these protections go away, like, you know, when this moderation goes away, the kinds of speech that seem to benefit from it are, you know, usually on one side of the, you know, of the issue, right? So I feel like, and I think I agree with you to the point, like, look, at the end of the day, these are private companies, and they can choose, like, Facebook can choose to stop moderating content, and you know, that's their prerogative. But like, it doesn't mean that you have to think it's a good thing. You don't have to be happy about that. You don't have to agree with that. I'm not saying that they can't. We're not saying that they can't do it. We're just saying that it's not a good idea, because the speech that was previously not allowed that will now be allowed is generally harmful, whether it's disinformation or it's, you know, cyberbullying or whatever it is. It's just generally not. It's, I don't know. It doesn't, like, it doesn't benefit anyone in any way. And I would say it oftentimes harms people.
Yeah. And I mean, and it's interesting to see, because the problem is there really is no independence between tech and politics at this point. Someone else was pointing out that Tim Cook gave money to Trump's inauguration. Is he a spineless little bitch too? Well, I think that's a little bit different. I don't agree with all of the CEOs donating to the inauguration, obviously, but I think it's pretty clear what's going on here. And that is that all of these CEOs of all of these tech companies are, let's be honest, they're a bit afraid. The thing for Meta is clearly Mark Zuckerberg wants to get himself sort of ingratiated with the current political moment, which seems to be a pretty strong push for conservatives and, you know, MAGA and all of that stuff. So that's, you know, he's aligning himself with that. That's what Elon Musk has been doing over the past 3 years. I mean, let's not forget that 6 years ago, Elon was tweeting about how Tesla and SpaceX were safe havens for the LGBTQ community. And then he just decided, maybe I'll make more money if I kind of go in with this crowd, right? So it's not, I mean, they're all spineless. In the case of Apple, I would make the same argument. I think it is spineless. And someone here pointed out these donations should be called bribes. I think basically what Apple is doing here, or what Tim Cook is doing, is being like, hey, don't forget about us. You know those tariffs? Yeah. We're gonna have to talk about those tariffs. Here's $1 million. Let's get back to this. We've seen it all before. I made a TikTok about this back before it was banned and then unbanned, where in the first Trump presidency, there were tariffs imposed on China, some of which, by the way, I agree with. Some of those tariffs have stayed in place under the Biden administration. And some of those tariffs, I mean, tariffs can be done strategically as those were. But what happened, I think it was 2017 and then again in like 2019, there were multiple conversations that Apple had with the then Trump administration about getting exceptions for those tariffs. Because, I mean, who would have thought? If you put blanket tariffs on products that get paid by the companies importing, those costs get passed on to consumers. And so it doesn't take a genius to figure out that Tim Cook went over there, said, hey, please don't tariff. We kind of need to not be tariffed. And then they gave them an exception. And then there you go. So that he's doing the same thing again. You know, there's nothing different here. It's just, let's say he's getting his foot in the door early.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to an extent, this kind of has to, like, given the way that the system works right now, this kind of stuff has to happen. Because obviously, you know, with all of these tariffs that are being talked about, that would be a huge problem for Apple. Like, you know, and exactly like you said, more increasing costs for Apple mean increasing costs for consumers or some kind of shrinkflation. I don't think Apple really does shrinkflation, though. I don't think... for the most part, that they really can, with at least with their core products. So it's usually, right, maybe the prices would just go up. And so, yeah, it's unfortunate given like the system that we're in that it has to happen this way. So do I blame them? Like, do I blame Tim Cook for doing it? I don't know. Maybe not. I can't imagine that he's outright supporting Trump or like trying to like help him out. Right. It's more of just like a, you know, don't forget about your old pal Tim Apple, you know.
So,
yeah, it's unfortunate though.
No, it definitely, it's pretty clear what's going on here, and all of these CEOs are doing it in their own way. Some of them are doing it by, I mean, honestly, I think Tim Cook has been the least political of it. Someone pointed out here that he did it himself instead of under Apple's name. Obviously, he has not made any statements. He has definitely not made a 3-minute video talking about how Apple has become emasculated, because that's what old Zucky boy did. He was like, oh yeah, actually, now that you mention it, Facebook, it's too much feminine energy. What? What are you talking about? That makes no sense. It's just ridiculous. Yeah, I think that was on Joe Rogan. Because here's the thing. This is the Joe Rogan podcast has become where you take a billionaire or a famous person, you put them through there, and they get washed and they get reborn again as either fully or lightly conservative man of the people. And then all of a sudden, the narrative on Mark Zuckerberg changes overnight, where, you know, before they're going, oh, this guy, he's a weirdo, he's a stooge for the Democrats because he did fact-checking, we hate this guy. And then all of a sudden he goes, oh, geez, Trump's about to be inaugurated. Let me go on Joe Rogan, talk about how, you know, vaguely feminized, and that's bad. And there we go. Now we're good. Stock price is saved. To think that any of these guys actually care about any of the issues that they claim to care about is kind of ridiculous. Which I guess brings us onto the TikTok ban, because I make the same argument about Trump on that one. Let's not forget, he was the guy that started the whole thing. He was the one who was talking about banning TikTok 4 years ago. So all of a sudden, boop, 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 tables turn. The ban goes through under the Biden administration. All of a sudden he goes, hey, I know how to score some points. I'm going to pretend that I never wanted that to happen, and I'm going to save it. And here we go again. They don't actually care about any of this.
I mean, you know, it's kind of a genius move to, like, you know, they started it. They let the Democrats actually do it. And then they immediately, you know, I don't think that was on purpose. I don't think that was the end game. But you know, if it was, someone was playing 4D chess there.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think you're right. I think it was from their perspective, what we would call a happy accident. They just kind of said, oh, look at that. All of a sudden now we can score some points. But it'll be interesting to see. You know, tomorrow is the actual inauguration. I would be very curious to see if these tariffs end up going through, what does that do for Apple? Because as you mentioned, the shrinkflation is not something that has really applied to Apple. They haven't really changed their pricing tiers. They certainly don't give you less iPhone in the box. Although I guess they do, they don't give you the headphones and they don't give you the charger brick, but that wasn't really related to, that wasn't in the last couple of years. So what'll be interesting to see is if you actually look at it, the iPhone price for like the Pro flagship iPhone has been $999 since 2017 now. That's a long time. So once you actually factor in inflation, you could very definitively make the argument that the iPhone has actually gotten technically cheaper. I've pulled up a little inflation calculator here. $999 in October of 2017 when the iPhone X came out has the same buying power as $1,278 today. Now, obviously, that's not, you know, an even comparison, but it is true that Apple's pricing doesn't change. They don't keep up with inflation. So I can't imagine if these tariffs were to go into effect that it wouldn't trickle down to consumers.
Yeah, and I wonder, like, how they would do it. Because I could kind of see, you know, two ways. So, for example, with the Pro Max phones, right, they're not available in 128. So Apple did that thing, what was it, 2 years ago, right, or a year ago, when they what was it, year and a half ago, right? Where they basically said for the Pro Max, you can only get it starting at 256, and so it starts at the higher price. But technically, you're getting the same, right? If you bought the regular Pro and you upgraded the storage, then it was the equivalent price increase. So technically, you weren't paying any more money, but in actuality, you were getting, basically Apple was forcing you. They were basically forcing you to pay for the storage upgrade, and the storage upgrade does not cost nearly as much as Apple charges for it. So that was kind of a way for them to increase the price without really increasing the price, although, you can argue about that. So I wonder if Apple would do something like that again. I wonder if they would do. We've heard rumors about like an iPhone Ultra for the past few years, and I feel like the big thing was when the iPhone X came out, and that started at $999. That was like a big jump. That was, I think, the last big price jump, major price jump for the iPhone. Obviously, the Pro Maxes are a bit more expensive than the Pros, but like for a while, the Pros have been $999. The Pro Max has been whatever it is, $1099, or it got a little more expensive because of the storage upgrade, but. But I wonder if Apple, if they ever do this iPhone Ultra that you've been hearing about, maybe, that'll be the next price bump, and maybe Apple will take advantage because it's harder for them to bump up the price of the iPhone, the iPhones that we get every year because people are going to be sensitive to that. If there's a new iPhone Ultra that, it's a new product, maybe they make it $100 more than they would have otherwise. And people don't know because it's a new product, right? But then it comes out, and that's maybe another way Apple could make up the money.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of touches on a really interesting perspective of this, which is when it let's say hypothetically that these tariffs do go into effect. We don't really know the timeline of that. It could be, I mean, it could be this week for all we know, right? So if and when these tariffs happen, what will be really interesting to see is how noticeable will that be? Like, will it become a transparent thing where companies will say, due to these tariffs, this is now more expensive? Like, will they just outright say it? Will they do what you're describing there? Like, let's say next year, all of a sudden, Apple, for whatever reason, decides not to offer the 128 gigabyte storage, and they do what they did with the, I think you're right. It was the 15 Pro Max. Where they just said it actually now starts at 256. So it was kind of a price increase, kind of not. Maybe that's how they handle it. I mean, the thing is, at the end of the day, tariffs do get passed on to consumers. We know this. This is not a debate. It's just basic economics. If I pay, like, let's say in the case of an iPhone, people always kind of pull up those bill of materials things. I don't know that that's terribly accurate because there's also manufacturing costs and shipping costs and all that stuff. But let's say it costs me $500 to manufacture an iPhone 16 Pro. I don't know if that's accurate, but let's just say for the sake of argument, that means my margin is about 50%. Now, I suspect Apple's is probably a little higher than that, but if I'm operating on a 50% margin with a $1,000 smartphone, and all of a sudden I get wind here that the new administration has given, let's call it a 20% tariff. So now all of a sudden my phone costs $600 because of the tariffs. I'm not just gonna eat that cost. I'm not just gonna call that a 40% margin now. I'm gonna say no. That's now I'm gonna make my phone $200 more expensive because then I maintain my margin. I mean, the long and the short of it is, it might not work directly like that because companies have to kind of fight on both ends. On the supply end, their product is now more expensive for them to get, which means to maintain their margins, they have to increase their prices. But they also know that if they increase their prices too much, people aren't going to just roll over. Like if Apple came out with the iPhone 17 Pro and it just happened to start at $1,199 instead of $999, even if we all knew that that was because of the tariffs, people are still going to be mad about that. and rightfully so. I'm going to be pissed. I don't want to pay $1,200 starting for an iPhone. So Apple will have to figure out, you know, how much of that do they absorb? How much of that do they pass on? It's going to be really interesting to see.
Yeah, and I feel like to your point, you know, obviously one approach could be to say, look, things are more expensive now because of the tariffs. I think that would be a very strong, because that's, you're basically, you're one step away from saying it's because of the Trump administration, it's because of Trump's policies that things are more expensive. And then, you know, if these companies are trying to keep, you know, a good relationship and they're trying to get, you know, they're trying to work with the government to you know, make a deal on the tariffs and whatever. And if, you know, Tim Cook is donating money to the inauguration, stuff like that, I feel like maybe they don't want to do something that aggressive. Even if that's the truth, even if, you know, that's the explanation, I feel like it could be seen as a bit of an aggressive move. Maybe, you know, they'd rather just use these other tactics. I could totally see Apple doing what they did with the Pro Max phones to more phones, I think, or to more products. I think for the Pro, the iPhone, you know, 17 Pro, for example, those, like, I feel like that would be a harder one to increase, because then you're like, okay, the Pro phone starts so much higher. But like the MacBooks, for example, they're still selling Macs with 128 gigs of storage. They really, that's a little bit silly in 2025 to have 120 gigs of storage on a computer, on a laptop. So I could see them dropping the 128 and maybe not making the 256 less expensive to take the place of it, but maybe they drop the 128 and they force some people to, you know, pay that extra $200. And obviously it doesn't cost Apple $200 to do that extra storage. And so Apple gets a little more money. And honestly, the people get a better computer in that case. So, you know, that could be worse. Hopefully, I'm hoping Apple takes approaches like that aren't, you know, as bad as they could be.
Yeah. No, I mean, it'll be interesting. I mean, tariffs are not, I personally suspect that the tariff stuff is largely going to be campaign bluster, because I think every economist knows what happens when you just slap tariffs on stuff. So I think it's probably unlikely that they're actually going to happen. And if they do, it's just going to be the most colossal throw of all time, because you get elected on the promise of lowering prices, and then you literally just add cost to every product. Let's see how that goes. Yeah, good luck with that. So I don't know that, I personally don't think that anything's going to happen. That's my take on it. But I do hope that, to your point, Apple does finally start reconfiguring some of their tiers. We do have a decent slate of new products coming in 2025. And one of the things that I'm really curious about is to see what happens with the base storage configurations. I don't think the M4 MacBook Air, which we're going to get this year, is going to be anything too spectacular. I think it's just going to be a chip swap in the existing MacBook Air chassis. So like the current MacBook Airs, it'll have 16 gigs of RAM, 256 gigs of storage. I think it'll be a fine upgrade, but nothing to write home about. But where I'm really curious is the MacBook Pro, because we have heard quite a bit of rumors about a new generation of MacBook Pro. And I'm starting to think that this year is going to be the year. So that, I think, presents an opportunity for Apple to finally stop offering 512 gigabytes as their base storage on the MacBook Pro. Because here's, whether it's this year or next year, this is how Apple tends to do it. I imagine the M4 MacBook Pro, which is $1,599, that will probably stick around. So that'll be the previous generation lower end computer that'll stick around as a middle one. And then, honestly, I do think Apple's going to increase the price. I think we're going to see this new generation at, like, maybe instead of $19.99, $21.99 or something like that. But hopefully for that money, We'll get a terabyte standard. I think we're finally going to get Face ID on the MacBook Pro. And there may be a new design. Again, I'm not 100% sure yet whether it's going to be a this year or a next year thing, but it will be interesting to see.
Yeah, I definitely feel like the MacBook, you know, a redesign is the opportunity that Apple would have to raise the price. And they could straight up, you know, come out and say, you know, oh, you know, this is the new MacBook Pro with all these great new things, and now it starts at $21.99 or, you know, whatever the new price is going to be. They could straight up do that. I could definitely see them doing a storage kind of thing. Maybe it's more expensive, but you get a terabyte. And then hopefully they update the MacBook Airs. I misspoke before when I said 128 gigs. I meant, you know, they start at 256. But I still stand by that 256 for a computer in 2025 is a bit low. And obviously Apple, you know, they're fine with that. They'll sell you iCloud storage and it's, you know, nice and integrated. So it's, you know, it's not a big deal, but, you know, for the consumer, but it would be better to have more storage. And so I could definitely see Apple taking the opportunity with the redesign to sneak in a price increase. And maybe they also increase the storage to soften the blow a bit. But, you know, same thing with the Pro Max iPhones. They're going to end up making more money because that extra storage that you get is not, doesn't cost them nearly the amount that, you know, the amount extra that you pay for it. So I could see it.
Yeah. And I mean, there's another thing that I'm really curious about as it pertains to storage, because it seems like Apple is kind of reversing course in some ways by adding removable storage to the new Mac Mini. That was not a move that I think anyone expected. But it means that Apple now sells desktops, all of their desktops, with technically user-upgradable storage, which is weird. You know, the Mac Pro is user-supported. Like, you can buy the storage from Apple. It's actually upgradable. Then the Mac Studio, they're a third-party replacements that you can buy that I reviewed on the channel that are really good, like perfect, honestly even better than factory, and a lot cheaper, less than half the price. And as this super chat from earlier pointed out, there are now replacement 1 and 2 terabyte M4 Mac Mini SSDs popping up on eBay. Now, I have not purchased any of those because those are reverse engineered and made in China by Chinese companies. And the company that I worked with that sent over their Mac Studio 8 terabyte SSD upgrades, they're a French company called Polysoft. And I just think the quality of their work is so much better that whatever marginal increase in cost and whatever marginal increase in time for me to get my hands on it, that is the one that I want to cover. And I know that they're working on prototypes, so I don't think it will be that long before I will be able to bring you guys a video with, you know, user upgradable storage for Mac Mini, which is crazy. Wild to think about. It's not something that anyone really expected. But as it pertains to the next generation MacBook Pro, which I would peg at probably maybe WWDC of 2026, it's going to be a little while. Apparently, there were delays with the OLED displays that they want to use. But what I'm really curious about is, do they add removable storage the same way that they do on the Mac Studio and the Mac Mini? Because that would actually be a game changer.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we would love to see it. And I feel like the current implementation that Apple has for their desktop systems, specifically for the Mac Mini and the Mac Studio, I feel like it really is a compromise. It seems like a compromise that they're willing to make, because basically Apple will not tell you that it's upgradable. They won't sell you storage upgrades. So for the vast majority of people that are buying these things, they're not even going to know that it's upgradable. Or maybe they'll find out, but they'll say, oh, it's this whole, you know, advanced thing. It's not supported by Apple, whatever, whatever. And they're just not going to do it. So for most people, it's not even going to be a question. And that's what Apple would like. They'd like for nobody to even bother with it. But for those small, you know, minority of people that actually do care about it and that really want to upgrade their storage, it is possible. It's not the simplest thing. It's not the easiest thing in the world, but it is possible. And I feel like the fact that it is possible is really cool. So I do hope that, like, I don't know if this is it's a new manufacturing process or a new component or a new design, whatever it is, but I hope that it carries over to the laptops. And, you know, again, it'll be the same thing. Apple's not going to sell you the storage upgrade. They're not going to tell you that you can upgrade the storage. But if it is possible to do it aftermarket, then that would be really nice. And I feel like for me personally, I would honestly maybe even buy a computer with less storage. I mean, I'd probably still buy a terabyte and I'd be okay with that. But like, I could see some people saying, you know, I'll try it with less storage. And then if it turns out that it's not enough, I can always upgrade it later. And it's not going to cost me as much to do it later as it would to do it up front, probably. And whatever, I just see it being a good thing overall. And I hope it does happen.
Yeah. And to add on to that, I have some thoughts as to why it might make sense for Apple to do the removable storage, because this is kind of something that has been talked about, but I think what's different now is there's actual tangible, visible evidence as to why it might make sense for Apple to do this. So, first of all, the new Mac Mini is actually really significant because it doesn't use storage and NAND in the same way that that the MacBooks have done it. So previously, all Apple Silicon devices, the higher end ones that can be configured with up to 8 terabytes of storage, they are able to do that by having literally just 8 NAND chips. So whether you buy a base model 14-inch MacBook Pro or a fully spec'd out 16-inch with everything on there, there are pads for up to 8 NAND modules, which means there has to be enough room on the logic board for all of that. But here's where it gets complicated, because if you order let's say even a 2 terabyte MacBook Pro, you're not using all 8 of those pads. Apple only uses the first 4 pads up till I think 2 terabytes. I don't remember exactly which configurations of NAND have which amounts of storage pads occupied, but only the 8 terabyte configurations actually use all the pads. And that means if you have anything less than 8 terabytes, you have 4 blank pads on your logic board, and all of the components that surround the SSD are not attached. So what that means is for all of these different boards that Apple is manufacturing, they are significantly different in the way that they are produced, because some of them have more empty pads than others. Some of them have more NAND components, like the little ICs and resistors and voltage regulators and all of those controllers. Those are going to be missing if you buy a 2 terabyte. They're going to be there if you have an 8. That's a lot of different types of configuration. And we already know that they have, you know, 6 or 7 different RAM options, multiple different binned SoCs. There's a lot of different configurations that Apple has to manufacture for these logic boards. So what makes it really interesting is that the M4 Mac Mini no longer uses 8 NAND modules to reach 8 terabytes of storage. They have a single removable card. The Mac Studio has 2 for 8 terabytes. But the M4 Mac Mini, I think they're using 2 terabyte NAND modules, which means they can get away with having a single card with only 4 pads. So when you look at the physical amount of space that that card takes up compared to the physical amount of logic board space that Apple is right now dedicating to these NAND pads that are almost always empty, it seems to me like it would not be an unreasonable thing to expect for Apple to just say, hey, turns out if we just take all of this extra board space off and put a socket on it, we can have more storage in a smaller footprint. We can manufacture less SKUs of these boards themselves, and we can just streamline the overall manufacturing process tenfold. I think that we are now at a point where the technology is once again favoring removable storage, which is why we saw it happen on the Mac Mini.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, obviously good. You know, if it's a win for everyone, if it makes things easier and less expensive for Apple and, you know, less complicated, and then for the consumer, it's obviously a good thing because, you know, we have the ability to do these upgrades. And obviously, you know, these companies have to put in the work and figure it out and manufacture these things. But the fact that it's possible is great. So it is good. And I guess, you know, to your point, the fact that there's this explanation and there's good reason, the fact that there is a benefit for Apple means that, first of all, there's a good chance it'll stick around at least for a while. And second of all, there's a good chance that it will come to other products. Because obviously, if this was just, you know, if we said, oh, it's because the Mac Mini is so small, and so they needed to, you know, do something different to accommodate the small size. And then you might say, well, I mean, the MacBook Pro,
which is
the MacBook
Pro
and the
true.
MacBook Air are also small, but whatever. It's a different, it's a flat board, and it's not like a, it's like a small tower. You know, whatever. The point is, you could say maybe some of it has to do with the fact that it's the Mac Mini itself. But if there's a benefit to Apple to do it on all of their products, then that would mean there's a higher chance that they will actually do it. I know this sounds pretty obvious, but like the fact that there's a chance that they will actually do it is great. And so hopefully that they, you know, they actually will do it for the MacBook Pros and the MacBook Airs and everything else as well.
Yeah, because I mean, think about Apple's entire philosophy right now is about streamlining, right? And so that means that you try to keep things as consistent as possible across devices and platforms. And we've talked about how that's both good and bad. I think both of us would tend to agree that 2024 was a bit of a lame year for Apple updates. Apart from Vision Pro, there was nothing really new and groundbreaking. There was nothing that was really like, wow. There was nothing terrible apart from the new AirPods Max, which I didn't buy because they were absolutely nothing. But there was nothing that was like, hey, Apple made a bold move and it was the wrong move. Or the right move, or any, they just didn't do anything bold last year. So my hope is that with 2024 and honestly even 2023 being a little bit on the, let's call it, the safe side of things, in 2025 and 2026, I'm hoping that we start to see some of these more exciting things finally coming out. Like, for example, this MacBook Pro redesign, this is, it seems like Mark Gurman is saying as of late last year, November of 2024, he's saying that this total redesign for the MacBook Pro was initially targeted for 2025, but there's been delays for the display technology. And I don't know. I feel like in reading a lot of this, I'm hearing what sounds like a pretty darn good machine shaping up here. If we're getting new display technology, to me that can only really mean tandem OLED, which I think would be unbelievably cool. You know, you're also talking about year-over-year chip upgrades. That'll be on the M6 chip at that point. But at the same time, when you take a step back and look at all of this, it kind of feeds into our narrative, Noah. 2026, that would make this current generation the longest unupdated generation of MacBook to date. It's hard to think because, you know, in my mind, it's still like the new generation, but came out 3 years ago in October. This year will be 4. Next year will be 5. Apple typically has only done 4-year cycles. So it is possible that we're watching Apple slow down with a lot of these updates.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, at least for the MacBook Pro, it's like such a it's a great computer, obviously. Like Apple Silicon was a complete game changer. We've talked about it so much on the show, but like Apple Silicon's a complete game changer. It's a great design. There are definitely some things that could be improved. I will say my 16-inch MacBook Pro is quite, you know, it's quite big, quite heavy, a little bit thick these days, especially with, you know, traveling. It's kind of a big thing to lug around. But like overall, I think from the perspective of the product, it's a great computer. It would take a lot for me to upgrade my current one, not just because I spent a ton of money on it, but also just because it's a great computer. But I think from Apple's perspective, you know, this design is getting a bit old. I think a lot of people that want a MacBook Pro, I think a lot of them have an Apple Silicon. And I think for the ones that are still holding out on Intel, maybe they're waiting for a redesign, or maybe they're just waiting for their current computer to die. But I feel like, you know, for a lot of people, once you get an Apple Silicon MacBook Pro, most people aren't going to want to upgrade. Like I have the M1, I have the one that came out, you know, the first current generation MacBook Pro. And I have no desire to upgrade to a newer one because it's a marginal improvement and it's, you know, it would be expensive to upgrade. So Apple, from their perspective, they need a redesign to prompt people or give people a reason to want to upgrade. But you know, if it goes a little bit longer with the current generation, because, you know, such a good generation, I don't think it's a terrible thing for consumers, but you know, maybe it's not what Apple wants in terms of making money.
Yeah, I don't know, dude. It's very interesting because I think you have to imagine that by delaying it from 2025 to 2026, that's going to cost Apple a lot of money, because I know for a fact that you're not buying a chip refreshed MacBook Pro, because the chip is not the limitation. And that's actually something that I'm talking about in my next video, which you will hopefully see soon, which is that we are entering a phase now on our devices, both phones and laptops, where the actual computing aspect of that device does not really age out in the lifespan of the device. Like we're not in a landscape anymore where your iPhone gets so slow that you can't use it. The chip is not wearing out. The battery, the display, the physical form of the phone or laptop is what's wearing out before the chip becomes unusable. So for Apple to offer these chip refreshes, obviously that's what they're going to do. And obviously it's working because they're providing some really incredible gains year over year. But to your point, Noah, I don't think there's a lot of people who bought an M1 or an M2 MacBook Pro that have now bought an M3 or an M4. I obviously buy them because that's my job. But like if I didn't get paid effectively to buy Apple products, I would not have upgraded any of these last two years, three different versions of MacBook Pro. I'd be just like you. And so every year of delay for a new generation is just costing them more money. I am curious though, like let's say 2026 rolls around. I know we're talking about realistically almost 2 years before we get a new generation of MacBook Pro, but would you consider upgrading to it at that point? Or are you so fine with your machine that you wouldn't even be tempted by a new, thinner, lighter design, OLED, Face ID, whatever it may be?
I feel like the thing that would get me, the thing that I'm most interested in right now would be thinner and lighter design. Because, you know, as I mentioned before, I've thought about getting a MacBook Air. I don't think I'm actually going to do that, but like I've thought about it, that like just imagine going the total opposite direction and having a 13-inch MacBook Air, and just it's just so light and portable, and you know, it's a nice, I don't know, at the end of the day, I don't think it makes a huge difference. Like when you stick it in the backpack, it's going to go in the same pocket of my backpack that my current laptop does, and my current laptop already fits in there, so that's fine. And yeah, it's lighter, but like it's in my backpack, going on my back. I don't know. It's not a huge difference. So I feel like even that is like that's what I'm interested in, like a thinner and lighter design. And if my MacBook Pro got destroyed somehow, like let's say I spilled water on it and it completely stopped working and I had to get a new one, then I would strongly consider getting a MacBook Air. But I think as long as this thing works, I'm not interested in or I'm not interested. It's just not enough of a reason. And so if a new MacBook Pro comes out and it has Face ID and it has OLED and it has, a thinner and lighter design and it has all of these things, maybe I would upgrade just because it's like, ooh, it's the new, it's the new thing and the new design is exciting. But like, I don't know if I would be that much better off having upgraded, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of speaks to where we are with technology as well. Like, I don't think many people, once you've kind of reached Apple Silicon, upgrading within Apple Silicon is a lot tougher of a sell, right? Because a lot of the benefits, I mean, this was obviously a seismic shift. I don't think anyone would say otherwise here in the chat, but like, it was not just, hey, now the chip is powerful. This was a complete rethinking of how the Mac is going to operate. And so when you go from an Intel machine to an Apple Silicon machine, your quality of life improves dramatically. But if you go from an M1 MacBook Air to an M3 MacBook Air, the average person not going to notice a difference, straight up. You're not going to be able to tell how much faster it is because when something is instantaneous, you can't get more instantaneous. That doesn't really work. That's not a thing. So the chip is that fast, it's just going to be that fast. You upgrade because maybe your batteries, like if you have an M1 MacBook Air, maybe you're saying, "Oh, I could definitely use a larger display, or my battery's maybe 3.5, 4 years old now. I'd like to get better battery life. I'd like more ports." Whatever those little reasons to upgrade may be, that's pretty much all that is getting people to upgrade. So I do think Apple is gonna have a bit of a crisis. I think specifically this year, with no redesign coming, I can tell you firsthand, it almost does not matter what Apple does if they do an M5 MacBook Pro refresh this year. I am not going to recommend that you buy it. The M4 was a really good generation, and my thought on that was basically, if you're not on Apple Silicon yet, get it right away. Whether it's a used one or one of those the new M4 generations, they're really good, they're really fast, solid upgrade. However, that is the last of it. I do not think we're now entering year 4 of this generation. Don't buy a new MacBook Pro in year 4 of its cycle. Even if it means you have to wait 2 years, buy yourself an M1 MacBook Air for $500 to tide you over if you have to. But I think that the time is coming where I'm gonna be issuing a halt order on buying MacBook Pros. We're getting there. Just you wait.
No, I agree. I mean, I don't see what they can do to it besides a refresh. Because even if they come out and they're like, yeah, we got the M5 chip, and it's somehow like still an impressive upgrade. Because, the past few chips have been pretty impressive given like it's not going to make a huge difference in terms of like your day-to-day tasks. But like the raw numbers have been not insignificant. And so even if Apple manages to do that again, now you have where you're like, okay, if they don't do a redesign this year, it's definitely coming next year. And then you're going to say, really buy the current design right before it's about to get a redesign. It's not worth it. Like you said, buy a used Mac. You can buy an M1 MacBook Air. Maybe even the M1 MacBook Pros. I mean, those are a few years old now. I don't know what the prices are looking like on those, but surely they've come down in price at least somewhat. So I definitely agree. Like, don't spend new Mac money on an M5 MacBook Pro if it's not a redesign, because it's just, yeah, the design, because then you know you're getting it next year. Just wait another year. Do whatever you have to do to wait another year.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, it's not hard to. If you're on a really old Mac, buy a cheap, newish Mac. That's really all I could say. I mean, honestly, look, a lot of people don't care. A lot of people would say, the general advice, and I do agree with this, is buy what you need when you need it. If you need an M4 Max MacBook Pro right this very second, then you should do that. I don't think planning out a 2 year gap in a hypothetical thing is a exercise in being financially smart. I think it's being a little, I think that's just kind of, putting it off because it's tech. It moves fast. If it was a car, if there was like a new, because cars will be like a 6 or 7 year purchase, almost guaranteed. And they're on 6 or 7 year cycles. So like if there's a new model of a car coming out pretty soon and you know it's coming, then yeah, you should wait 2 years. Not necessarily with a MacBook. But once we get towards the later part of this year, I'm gonna start notching up my hesitance to recommend newer things. But John actually popped in the chat here with another great point, which is setting aside the MacBook Pro, what is up with the Ultra chip? Where is that going to be? That's a great point because they skipped the M3 Ultra. Are they? I imagine they're not going to skip the M4 Ultra. I guess in terms of events this year, and we'll talk more in depth about, when we think our first event is going to be. We'll do that next week. But I think for the Ultra chip, it's got to be March or June. That's what my money's on.
Yeah, I think, yeah, obviously, we skipped a generation for the Ultra. Apple needs to upgrade, especially because the past few chips have had these pretty significant gains that the Ultra chips have, they've kind of like relative to the Pro and Max and even regular chips, like the other chips below the Ultra have caught up or are catching up. And so I feel like the Ultra chip obviously needs to be upgraded as well. Hopefully that will happen this year. And I think, yeah, I think Apple, they want to do it, I think, sooner rather than later so that they can get these new products out. And I'm also just thinking, like, when the MacBook Pro comes out, I think we were kind of discussing that, the past few Apple Silicon chips have been a big focus on these the numbers, like the oh, it's 20% faster, 12% faster, whatever it is. And I think we were kind of saying that when the MacBook Pro redesign happens, Apple will probably focus a lot more on the redesign than they'll focus on the performance increases. And so maybe whatever chip that is, if it's the M5 or the M6, I guess we're talking about the M6 at this point, whatever that chip is will probably be a bit less of an upgrade. And so I think if Apple is able to get the Ultra chips out before that happens, then when those chips come out and they're not as much of a performance increase and Apple focuses more on the redesign, it will kind of help the Ultra to stay relevant for longer because the lower end chips, or really any chip below the Ultra, won't catch up quite as fast as they have in the past. And maybe you'll get a little more, the Ultra will really stand out for a bit longer.
That's true. That's a good point. I mean, you're definitely right. Like the Ultra chips, the M2 Ultra, which is what I'm using right now in my Mac Pro. I didn't even get 2 years out of that thing before the M4 Max is pretty much just as fast, if not arguably a little faster, because the Ultra chips are interesting because they are, literally just two Max chips fused together. That fusion interconnect, which was apparently no longer a part of the M3 and the M4 Max. So, what'll be interesting to see is if Apple makes this new chip a monolith instead of gluing chips together, I think that'll also make it last a lot longer. Because to your point, obviously going from M2 to M3 to M4, those are pretty decent jumps, such that you get the situation that I'm in, where I'm like, dang, I spent $8,000 on this Mac Pro, or, you know, $6,000 on a Mac Studio or whatever it may be. And now you could get an M4 Pro Mac Mini that gets pretty darn close for like $1,300. But I think with a monolithic chip structure, you would have a lot better scaling, because the Ultra chips don't scale all that well, especially the M1 Ultra. The M1 Ultra was actually kind of buggy and a little laggy to use. The M2 is better for sure, but it's still, you can tell that it's not as fluid and it's not as like seamless as the M4 Max or even the M3 Max. Like that I think is going to be a really interesting thing to see. But at the same time, holy heck, that's going to be an expensive chip. Because if the M4 Ultra comes out and it literally is one single die with like 80 GPU cores, 30 CPU cores, that's going to be a huge bit of silicon. That is not going to come cheap.
Yeah, but I could definitely see, I guess at the point, you know, when Apple has four chip levels, they have the basic, Pro, Max, Ultra, they want to differentiate those levels. And, you know, like we've both just said, the lower level chips are starting to catch up to the higher level chips. And so, like, you know, to your point, you know, you buy a Mac Pro, a Mac Studio, you shell out all that money for the Ultra chip, and then a couple years later, you know, there's something a lot less expensive that's comparable. Now, obviously, you know, you had those 2 years that you were using this fast chip versus waiting 2 years for the faster chip to arrive and then spending less money. You're always going to spend less money to get the more performance earlier, right? There's all those variables, time, money, whatever. You know, you can oftentimes throw more money at something to improve it, right? And so it makes sense. But I could see, you know, if Apple really wants to differentiate these things and they want to kind of separate them out enough where this catching up doesn't happen as quickly as it has been, maybe they do a really expensive Ultra chip. Maybe it is more expensive than it is right now, but, you know, there's three other levels of chip that are less expensive than that that you can choose from. And if it means that the Ultra being a monolith makes it work better, and it's just it's a better chip in every way, it's less buggy and it's quicker and it's more powerful than the other Ultra, maybe that's a good thing at the end of the day. More expensive, but maybe, you know, Apple's okay with that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And it really is all about time and money, right? You can just wait. Any chip that Apple announces, you wait long enough, a MacBook Air is going to be able to do that, right? An M2, there will be one day a MacBook Air that will be faster than the M2 Ultra that I'm using right now. It's only a matter of time. But you buy what you need when you need it. And I think with the Ultra chips especially, you really are paying for, I want the absolute most and I want it right now. I don't want to wait a year and buy something cheaper or used or whatever it may be. You're saying, I need the most amount of performance that money can buy and I need it this very second. But I'll tell you what, unfortunately, else we need, and that is to end the podcast.
Yeah, we've gone a little bit over, but it's okay, given that we've missed a few, you know.
Well, yeah, just a little bit. But we'll be back next week, I think.
I will still be away. Oh, no. So I'm not sure about next week. But after that.
Oh, no.
Okay, but here's the thing. After next week, I actually don't have any firm travel plans. Not to say I'm not going to travel. Whoa. But I don't have any firm travel plans. So I will be around. If you'll be around, I'll be around.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I think I will be back for February 2nd. I have a trip that weekend, but I think I should be able to be back by that point. But I will definitely keep you updated on that front. Okay. So we'll see. I'm giving it like a good 75% chance that we'll be on for February 2nd. It's just, I have to drive back from a trip that day. And I'm pretty sure that I'll be able to make it in time.
All right, well, just step on it.
Yeah, I will. Don't you worry. I'll be fully charged, and I'll put it in sprint mode.
Oh, yeah. All right, we'll be good.
Hell yeah. All right, well, thank you guys so much for joining us. I've been your host, Luke Miani.
And I've been your host, Noah Rubin. We will see you next time, and have a great night.